The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello all, welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Well, in the past 3 weeks, we've had some amazing guests, all in honor of CJSR's annual Fund Drive campaign. We kicked it off with Adam Savage of Mythbusters fame, then featured science comedian Brian Mallow, and ended with Randall Munroe, creator of the webcomic XKCD. Now, those three fantastic guests I mentioned, they all have something in common. Beyond the fact that they're all science-focused, and beyond the fact that they're all hilarious, they're also all Americans. Now, the skeptic community is pretty American-centric for a lot of good reasons. They have popular and visible celebrities. They have some great organizations. Great. And they've done some amazing work. And they also seem to bear the brunt of the majority-supported irrational thought processes. So it's understandable that we all know about what's going on in the U.S., sometimes more than we're aware of what's going on in our own backyards. So today, it's time to talk about skepticism in Canada. And we have three lovely Canadians with us today. We have John Abrams, the latest founder and president of the Ottawa Skeptics. He organizes local events, makes media appearances as the token skeptic, and is the host of the Reality Check podcast. And in his other life, he's a computer engineer. We also have Jesse Bradle from Vancouver, a lifelong science nerd who studied physics at the University of British Columbia, and he's been involved with the Center for Inquiry in Vancouver as a volunteer organizer for a little over a year. And we also have Steve Toms from Ontario's Niagara region. He studied recorded music production at Fanshawe College and political science slash history at Trent University, and he now teaches guitar, piano, drums, and the saxophone. He blogs at Some Canadian Skeptic and is also the editor-in-chief of the new Canadian blog, Skeptic North. So there won't be a speaking up today, as we have a lot to talk about, but we are absolutely still accepting segments for future shows. And if you're listening right now and you have an event or a topic related to the skeptical community that you'd like to talk about on air, please do send us an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Just put speaking up in the subject line, briefly tell us what you'd like to discuss, and we'll contact you. And this applies to Canadians, Americans, Australians, or anyone else that has something interesting to say. So I'm very much looking forward to letting you all in on what's happening in Canadian skepticism right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. So there are many, many stereotypes about Canada. That it is extremely cold. That we are unfailingly polite. And that we're the world's main exporter of quirky dramatic comedies with great soundtracks and low production values. But today, I'd like to set the record straight about one claim in particular. The one that assumes that there's nothing skeptical going on in Canada. I'm joined by Jesse Bradle of Vancouver. Jesse, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yep, I gotcha. We're also with John Abrams of Ottawa. Hello, John.
Hey, how you doing, Desiree?
Thanks for being here. And Steve Toms of Ontario's Niagara region. Steve?
Howdy, thanks for having me.
All right, so I was speaking about stereotypes, but let's go with some evidence-based stuff, some specific issues. What are some of the big ones that are going on in Canada right now? Like H1N1 has been in the news quite a bit. Steve, do you want to give us some background on that?
Yeah, it's a really serious issue right now, and there's a lot of compounding factors at play this particular year. One source of the confusion is around the seasonal flu shot. The regular flu season lasts from about mid-October to mid-April, and this year is going to be no exception. The various agencies responsible for prepping the seasonal flu vaccine often do their best to predict which flu strain is going to be responsible for a given flu season. But there are fears that getting the seasonal flu vaccine this year would make a person more susceptible to H1N1. This fear is based on a study that has still not gone through the peer review process, nor has its findings been replicated. But this didn't stop the Canadian media outlets from telling this particular story, even though they were careful to point out that the information was pulled from an unpublished study. Now, another cause of confusion is coming from the usual anti-vaccination forces, the people that claim that getting a flu shot will give you the flu or some other far worse disease because it's all part of some massive pharmaceutical government collaboration designed to make people sick so that it will continue to line the pockets of big pharma. But now, two notes on that. It's physically impossible to get the flu from a flu shot because the flu that you get in the vaccine is a deactivated virus. That is to say that the virus itself is unable to use the host's DNA to reproduce.
But nonetheless, people still say, I don't get the flu shot because it gives me the flu every time. So it's absolutely impossible for that to happen.
Yeah, it is physically impossible. Now, you can get these flu-like symptoms, this is true, but these symptoms are not contagious, and so they no longer pose a public health risk. Even though you may be bedridden for a day and a half with some pretty bad symptoms, you're not going to make anybody else sick around you because
right.
They're not the actual flu. And as to a note about the government profiteering, with all the anti-vaccination hysteria that's been out there, pharmaceutical companies got a little bit gun-shy, and they just haven't been producing vaccines like they used to back in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And there's actually very little profit in making vaccines because the major reason that companies even bother to make them nowadays is because the government has decided that it would just be a good idea to have a stockpile of vaccines in case of an outbreak.
Right. So what's going on in Ontario with it? Is there anything interesting?
Well,
no big outcry.
The various health agencies in Canada have been active in combating the misconceptions about H1N1 and the vaccine around it, but I think they're largely ignoring the attacks from the alternative medicine community. I think partially because homeopathy and acupuncture and naturopathy don't normally fall under the crosshairs of Health Canada.
Right.
But the organizations that are backing these alt-med communities make these continuous attacks, and they're usually laced with the language of conspiracy, poisoning your body, profits, and alt-med, and it's non-invasive and gentle, and it uses your own body. But the science that drives Health Canada knows that this kind of stuff is nonsense, so it barely gives it a second glance. But the sad fact is that these charges by the alt community get a lot of press, like the one that I mentioned a moment ago about getting the H1N1 vaccine or seasonal vaccine would make you more susceptible to H1N1, even though it's not been published and has not been scientifically peer-reviewed just yet. So people are choosing to not get themselves vaccinated or their loved one vaccinated, which, of course, puts all of public health at risk.
Right. Now, Jesse, continuing on the vaccine issue, there was recently an outbreak of mumps in BC, correct?
Yeah, that's right. In, I believe it was August of 2008, there were over 200 cases of mumps, and that originated from a religious community that didn't vaccinate their children on fundamentalist religious grounds. So it's not the same kind of thing that we're starting to see with the Jenny McCarthy anti-vaccination stuff. But still, it was pretty bad. And those kind of communities pose just as much of a health risk to the public as Jenny McCarthy does.
Right. Now, John, you had some information about healthcare practitioners refusing to be vaccinated.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a controversy here in Ottawa, at least in my newspaper.
that I read the Ottawa Citizen, it seems that there's a bit of a controversy that started about a month ago, where the health practitioners at first didn't want to be vaccinated for whatever reason, or at least have the option to not do it. And there's been a series of articles and letters back and forth, and Health Canada eventually decided, fine, the frontline healthcare workers do not have to be forced to be vaccinated. And I've also noticed online that now the anti-vaccine supporters are taking that decision, saying, see proof, you don't need the vaccine. Even Health Canada is saying you don't need it. And they've been twisting it, and it's very annoying. And it's very sad that this debate even has to happen, because you'd think that the healthcare providers on the front lines should know that the vaccines are safe and are important for your health. And they're role models, too, for the public. You know, like, how can a frontline health worker be able to give the line that you're supposed to get vaccinated if they're not willing to do it themselves? And there's no reason not to, because it's free and it's safe.
Well, you just mentioned the anti-vaccination people. Now, there's no actual formal anti-vaccination organization in Canada, is there? Unlike the U.S. and, I believe, Australia.
I think there might be actually a anti-vaccination institution in Canada, but they seem to have a very minor voice. They don't seem to get much airplay or media exposure. But most of the anti-vaccination nonsense I'm seeing is on the internet. Whenever there's an article on like the CDC website or the CTV website relating anything to do with swine flu or vaccines, people just, you know, hammer the comment section saying, "Oh, I'm not doing this. It's unhealthy. It's a scam. Blah blah blah." That sort of thing, which is just very unfortunate. So right now, it seems that it's still kind of grassroots. And I think it's important that we tackle this head on first to prevent it from getting out of control like it did in the UK and starting to in the US.
Now, Jesse, is there actually any kind of anti-vaccination movement going on in Vancouver at all?
I wouldn't say that there's a centralized anti-vaccination movement, but there's definitely a push against vaccinations from, you know, there are crazy people on the internet with their websites like Jonathan was talking about. And the naturopaths as well, who have been given expanded rights and abilities in BC just recently, are many of them are anti-vaccination. The College of Naturopaths in BC is officially neutral, and so neutral's in quotations, like how in, you know, the Texas school board has to stay neutral on evolution. So a lot of naturopaths are actively discouraging people from getting vaccinated.
Right. So, listeners, as always on Skeptically Speaking, we love to hear people's perspectives. Call us at 780-492-2577. You can Skype us at Skeptically Speaking, or email live at skepticallyspeaking.com, or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So let's get a little bit into alternative health here, because you mentioned the naturopaths, and in BC specifically, I'm sorry. I feel bad for you, Jesse, because there's a lot of stereotypes about Vancouver, really, about the alternative health community.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll touch on that
true.
A little bit later. I'll just give you my my thoughts and my pity, if you don't mind, and we'll move on.
Okay.
Instead of vaccinations, you have that community saying that we should be using homeopathy. And for those in the audience that don't know, that maybe don't listen on a regular basis, there's not one piece of double-blind, peer-reviewed evidence that shows that homeopathy is helpful for anything. Scott Guevara was on the show a few weeks ago speaking about an article in the Georgia Strait, which is one of the alternative weeklies in Vancouver, that was promoting homeopathy instead of vaccination for H1N1. Jesse, why don't you just talk about some of the alternative health issues that are going on in Vancouver?
Well, you mentioned the article about homeopathy in the Georgia Strait. That's something that the skeptics community in Vancouver has sort of been focusing on lately. And that's, I feel kind of bad for this one homeopath in particular who we're all jumping on. She's become a bit of a scapegoat for the whole movement. But, you know, she's recommending not to vaccinate your children, to not, you know, give them allergy medications, that sort of thing. She sells homeopathic first aid kits, and it seems like that's pretty standard for homeopaths around Vancouver, and there are plenty of them. And, you know, similar to the naturopaths, I was surprised to find, I mentioned just recently the naturopaths were given expanded abilities. So to listen to the naturopaths talk about it, they'll tell you that, well, you know, now we can offer prescriptions for herbs and minerals that used to require a prescription. But it's actually much more than that. They're able to perform some minor surgeries. They're able to use x-rays. They can perform allergy tests, which is a specialized thing that only an allergist should be able to do. And basically, they have every ability to act as a family doctor now, which goes against everything that the naturopaths say that they're doing, you know, natural cures, non-invasive, personalized medicine, that sort of thing. But it turns out that that's not the case.
So how did they get those expanded abilities?
Politicians, it seems like. I don't know exactly what the Minister of Health in BC, you know, what his personal feelings are. But it sounds to me like he was the main push behind it, and I believe his name is George Abbott. Mm-hmm. The BCMA, the British Columbia Medical Association, put out a document that's very strongly worded against these expansions of the naturopath's abilities, where they highlight all of this stuff that the naturopath are asking for. They explain why they shouldn't have it, basically. The training is insufficient. There are conflicts of interest. You know, doctors aren't allowed to sell their own treatments to their patients, but naturopaths are. So there's a conflict of interest there. Do they give the proper medical treatment, or do they push their own expensive
right.
detox, whatever it is? And there are more points there as well. You can find the document on BCMA's website. But despite that, it went through, and it seems like it was a political thing.
John, this had a different outcome in Ontario. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, right now there's a bill being proposed to the Parliament here in Ontario, Bill 179. And Scott Gavura of the Science-Based Pharmacy blog, who I believe is a friend of the show, he covers this quite well on his blog, where he discusses that this proposed bill about just addressing the powers of various health practitioners, and they purposely left out the provision to allow naturopaths to be able to prescribe drugs, which is a good thing, which is a positive outcome. And we just passed the deadline a few days ago being able to make suggestions to amend the bill. And there's some crazy suggestions that have been suggested, but luckily it looks like it's going to pass and be mostly science-based.
What were the crazy suggestions?
Well, we got an Ontario naturopath recommended using detoxing and cleansing. A Markham, Ontario naturopath believes a routine physical exam should include measuring the body's pH and looking for signs of toxins in the stomach. A Toronto naturopath recommends liver cleansing for eczema. She also recommends homeopathy for diabetes, and so on, herbal rinses, the typical nonsense that you hear coming out of the alternative medicine crowd. And also, to change the subject back to what we were talking about before, the vaccination awareness, you asked me about if there's any nationwide organizations that are anti-vaccine. I found it. It's the It's the Vaccination Risk Awareness Network. So if you ever see them in the newspaper, like a quote from the Vaccination Risk Awareness Network, which sounds very mild and very positive and mm-hmm. supportive, they're the anti-vax guys.
And where are they based?
I am not sure. Their website is vran.org. So you can find all the information about them there.
Well, I've never heard about them, so that's a good sign.
Yeah, that, again, the important point is that they're marginalized so far, and that they don't have much say.
So why do you think there was such a difference in these proposals? Why can Vancouver naturopaths now prescribe?
I don't know. It could just be dumb luck that they might have some friendly politicians in their parliament, and we do not, or they have enough of them, and we don't have enough in ours. It seems like here in Canada we have a lot of alternative medicine practitioners in the mm-hmm. government. We've got chiropractors in the federal parliament. We've got we have a chiropractor as our minister of science and technology, which is lovely.
Hear that, listeners?
Not to mention the fact that he not only doesn't believe in evolution, but he doesn't understand what it is or understand what science is. That was a controversy that appeared about 6 months ago and kind of died down, but he's still there. I actually started up an online petition to get rid of them, but that hasn't seemed to go anywhere. You can try going to goodbyegoodyear.com if you want to sign that petition.
Does anyone have any other alternative health issues that are going on in your regions?
Yeah, you know, if I can go back to the vaccinations for just a moment, something that I found in researching this that was, I guess, not surprising. I was a little surprised at the scale. I found a graph of infant vaccination. So this is by 2 years old, the rate of vaccination by region in BC. So overall in BC, two-year-olds, 65% of them are up to date in their vaccinations. Vancouver Island has the best rate at about 73%. But the worst vaccination rate, which is actually below 50%, it's about 48% right now, is the North Shore, which anyone from BC will know that the North Shore, North Vancouver, West Vancouver is the most affluent and wealthiest region. And that's sort of in line with what I've heard before. We had Dr. Harriet Hall, the SCEP doc, give a talk about alternative medicine in Vancouver a few months ago. And she mentioned that this is pretty common to what she's seen in the States. It's the worried well. It's the people with more money than sense, you might say.
I like that phrase, the worried well.
Yeah. So it's a little bit troubling that it's not the undereducated. It's not the low-income people who are falling for this anti-vaccination stuff. It's actually the wealthiest and the most able to provide proper health care to their own children.
That's interesting information.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Alternative health?
Well, actually, there is. It's not really in the realm of alternative health, but it is vaccine related. In Ontario, the Catholic School Board has banned the distribution of the HPV vaccine,
right.
Gardasil,
right.
And they've done so. I don't want to say on religious grounds because that's not actually true, but they do it under the auspices that if we give these young girls the HPV vaccine, then it will lead to sexual promiscuity when they're older, and it will also lead to premarital sex. And so we don't want to give these girls this potentially life-saving vaccine.
I'm still never going to catch the logical connection there. How does giving a girl a vaccine make her? I don't. What's the thought process behind that? Can somebody explain that to me? Their thought process. I'm not saying an evidence-based one.
It also says too that anybody or any woman that gets cervical cancer, which is what HPV can do, is kind of deserving because they were sexually promiscuous. Now, the thought process is that it doesn't put the fear of respectability in you. You're like, well, I don't got to worry about because apparently the only reason why girls don't have sex is because of fear of the HPV virus.
Fascinating.
And, it's kind of bothersome.
That wouldn't be what I said. So, audience, please do get involved in the conversation. Whether you're a Canadian wanting to talk about what's going on in your area or you have questions for our panel, please do call in 780-492-2577. You can also Skype us at Skeptically Speaking, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And I think we'll go straight to a phone call. Go ahead, caller. Are you there?
I am, yep.
Hi, go ahead, Kim.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on for vaccinations. One thing that that's a concern to me is just over-vaccinating for just anything. And what's wrong with letting the body build up its own antibodies for certain things and a person becomes healthy if they're given an opportunity to fight a particular disease on its own. And for, people that are not at risk for certain things, why not let them just do what the body should do naturally? And I'm not speaking from any knowledge about knowing what goes into vaccines, but is there not a danger in what they use to make up the vaccine, like horse serums, and shouldn't that be a concern when people are getting vaccinated?
Panel, who wants to take it?
I can take that one.
Great.
Well,
thanks very much, caller.
Yeah, thank you. The problem is that sometimes the body doesn't heal itself fast enough, or there can be some fundamental kinetics that the virus or these invading bacteria can have that the body just can't combat in time, and that also in turn means that these viruses and bacteria can mutate faster than not only an individual can deal with, but a group of individuals. It's this basis called herd immunity, that 95% of a population can still be protected, but if any more than that 5 or 6 left over does not get vaccinated or is unprotected, then that is still enough of a small localized population of a virus or bacteria or otherwise these similar illnesses that can mutate and that can basically evolve and infect everybody else. So it's fine for some things like the cold, where like the body just has to work through it. But for something like the H1N1 virus, people are dying because of this, and people have died because of the flu in years past, and they will die again in the future. It's horrible, but we do have the tools to combat it, and if we don't combat it, then we are risking another 1917 influenza outbreak, and H1N1 is not only taking down the susceptible, like the children and the elderly, it's also taking down healthy people. I don't think that this is the kind of thing where we can just sit by and rely on our own individual immune systems to deal with.
All right. I don't want this to become the all vaccine episode. So, and I realize we've just received a bunch of emails and there's calls waiting on the line. So I'm going to get to those calls and emails right after this.
Next week on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about how the skeptical community goes about getting noticed. From comedy and music to scientific studies and how we respond to them, to blogging versus mainstream media to attention-grabbing stunts. Is all publicity good publicity, or do our own efforts sometimes work against us? We'll be joined by Greg Layden, biological anthropologist and author of Greg Layden's blog, and Omar Muhalim, a.k.a. MC AOK, associate editor at Avenue Magazine. Call in and question everything on the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. This is Desiree Schell, and I am talking with a lovely bunch of Canadians tonight. Steve Toms of the Skeptic North blog, Jesse Bridle of CFI Vancouver, and John Abrams of the Ottawa Skeptics. So one thing that we've been talking a lot about specific issues, and one thing that doesn't really seem to be much of an issue in Canada, that's definitely a problem elsewhere, is the evolutionism creationism debate. And actually, it's not an issue anywhere else except for here in my province, where I live. We recently passed legislation that will give parents the option of pulling their children out of class when lessons on sex, religion, or sexual orientation are being taught. And it was actually an amendment to our human rights legislation. And it requires that school boards give parents written notice when controversial topics are going to be covered. Parents can then ask for their child to be excluded from the discussion. This legislation can be used during any class that touches on evolution. Anyone else enjoying anything of this nature?
Well, in Ontario, I spent my education in the Catholic School Board, which is a state-funded school board. We generally think of religious education as not teaching evolution, but I learned evolution in my Catholic school board. I remember it being taught in grade 10. It may have been taught earlier. I just don't remember it. I can speak for the Ontario School Board. Evolution is definitely part of the curriculum, and we are tested, or we were tested on it. I haven't been in the high school for a long time, but it's around.
I, on the other hand, went to a Ontario public school, and it was not taught at the same level that it was in the Catholic board. We did not learn it in general grade 10 science. At the time I went to school, we still had a grade 13 OAC, and back when I went, evolution was taught when you took grade 12 biology, which was an optional elective course, which I did not take. So I, in fact, never learned evolution in high school. I did learn it as an aside when I took my ancient history and human history course, where they explained, you know, in just one class how humans evolved from apes, and then that's that. But we didn't actually learn how evolution works and all the ins and outs about it. And it's kind of sad because it's a fundamental science. It should be taught right at the start. You can't learn the rest of biology just does not make any sense unless it's in the light of evolution. So it's kind of bizarre that it's taught so late in the game. I wonder if there's any kind of influence from the Protestant history of the public school system, because the public school system here in Ontario evolved out of the Protestant school system, and the Catholic school system remains separate, yet publicly funded.
And I believe we have a call on this topic. Go ahead, caller.
Hi. I don't know. I was actually going to ask about the chiropractic, because you mentioned there is that fellow in that was the head, the director of the science situation.
Yeah, that's Gary Goodyear, the Minister of Science and Technology.
Yeah. I was just wondering, because I wasn't quite able to discern obviously this sounds like a strange thing for a person who doesn't believe in evolution or whatever to be part of that. You did mention he was a chiropractor. I was wondering, like, if you were connecting those two things.
Well, yeah, chiropractic is a pre-scientific form of medicine that believes that all disease is caused by invisible, undetectable subluxations or misalignments in the nerve pathways of the spine. And I shouldn't be so general. There's a bit of a variation amongst chiropractors, but
yeah,
as it originally was designed, and as many chiropractors still practice today, they still practice with that initial philosophy that all diseases can be cured with chiropractic treatments or back and neck adjustments. But there are chiropractors that practice today by only treating lower back pain, which is what there is evidence for chiropractic. So there is some evidence that chiropractic can treat lower back pain, but everything else, the evidence is missing. And so
right.
I would have characterized that as unscientific.
Oh, hmm.
If I may add to this, actually, just for clarity's sake, his actual position is Minister of State for Science and Technology. Now, being Minister of State is a junior cabinet position. We no longer have a Minister of Science and Technology. We have these various ministers of state, like such as for amateur sport is another one. So he doesn't actually design science or technology policy. He advises senior cabinet members on science and technology, but also as far as Mr. Goodyear's other background, he also has extensive acupuncture and naturopathic education as well. He does have an undergraduate degree at the University of Waterloo in biomechanics and psychology. He actually left before completing his degree, but he did go to the Canadian Memorial Chiropractic College, and he also studied extensively in acupuncture and naturopathy as well.
Thanks, Steve. And thanks, caller. We have an email as well. But before that, I'm just going to say again, the lines are open. It's 780-492-2577. You can also Skype us at Skeptically Speaking, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. Go ahead, Ryan.
The question is, what became of Bill C-51? Would it have been a good bill?
Who wants it?
Oh, I think I have to take that one. Because our organization, the Auto Skeptics, we were the only organization out there that even said anything remotely positive about that bill. And we kind of became like the de facto authority on Bill C-51. I guess the opponents probably would disagree with that. So we have a whole series of articles about Bill C-51. So if you want to learn a lot about it, then please visit autoskeptics.org. But I'll give you the quick gist of it. It was basically a modification for the Consumer Product Protection Act, and it was scheduled to occur since the re-regulation of all these products began, I think it was in 2004 or so, and it would have gone through, or it would have been proposed even if the Liberals were in power. It's a long time coming type thing, where this bill would have addressed a lot of different items. One of them was drugs and medical devices and NHPs. Now, in Canada, NHPs, natural health products, are considered a separate category from drugs. But in this bill, it uses this one umbrella term to refer to all medical products. And for some reason, word got out that NHPs were now going to be treated as drugs, it spread like wildfire, and it just wasn't true. Like, the regulation wouldn't really have changed that much for NHPs. And what you started seeing is in natural health food stores and chiropractic offices, you started seeing all these pamphlets appear, Stop C51. And there was a very slick website called stopc51.com. And through investigations by Daniel Loxton of Junior Skeptic Magazine, who's in Vancouver in Canada, he discovered that it was an AstroTurf campaign started by a company that sells a cocktail of vitamins that they claim treats all sorts of mental disorders, like schizophrenia and autism. And they basically spread tons of misinformation out there to get everybody riled up, and they pushed all the right buttons. They knew how to get this crowd to be very much against it, which is actually kind of funny, because the actual naturopathic organizations were in favor of the bill, because they've always been in favor of regulating NHPs, or natural health products, because it helps lend them credibility. Which gets us to another factor that sets Canada apart from our neighbor to the south, which is that we regulate natural health products here in Canada. That includes homeopathy and herbal medicines, where
right.
if you go to the pharmacy or the natural health food store and you look at a bottle of homeopathy, there will be a number on there given by Health Canada. And so that's also a new controversy going on now, which is there's a giant backlog of natural health products that are awaiting regulation that people are afraid aren't going to make it through. So that's another issue. But Bill C-51 died on the floor when the election was called last year. It's going to be reintroduced soon. It hasn't been reintroduced yet. There's a Bill C-6 that's been introduced, but that's the new version of Bill C-52, mm-hmm. Which there was a bit of complaining by the alt-med community about that, but this time they're going to be very careful with their wording, so they can't be taken out of context again. It was a huge headache for the government and Health Canada. So stay tuned to autoskeptics.org about this topic. We got it covered.
Nice plug, sir. We just received another email.
Question is, are you aware of any uniquely Canadian skeptical issues?
It's a very good question.
Ogopogo.
Good call.
Sasquatch is pretty distinctly Canadian.
That's true. Yes.
Well, the U.S. has Sasquatch, too. So.
They stole it.
That's it, eh? We got fictional creatures. Oh. Good.
Well, we have all sorts of different... we have our own conspiracy theory with the Avro Arrow.
Right.
That's right.
We also have various alternative histories, like... There are people that claim that the Vikings made it to the north shore of Lake Ontario. That was a hoax that was perpetrated. Someone planted some fake Viking equipment around there. Other than that, Canada's pretty dry for controversy.
Do you guys know about Oak Island?
The witch?
Oak Island? Really interesting story. You can look it up on Wikipedia. It's supposedly pirate gold is buried deep beneath. There's a big pit that people have been trying to dig out for hundreds of years. And it's actually something that I was interested in when I was younger in my pre-skeptical times. I thought there may be a bit of truth to it, but it seems like there's not. It's in the Maritimes.
There could be gold there. They just have to dig further.
That's the obvious response.
Well, there's a bunch of spooky stuff about traps and the ocean floods in because there were tunnels dug specifically to stop people, and there are tablets warning of all kinds of horrors that lie merely 10 feet below, and no one's ever gotten that far. It's a pretty cool story.
So what I was referring to there about the Viking relics, that's known as the Beardmore relics, Beardmore.
You're on Google right now, aren't you? I can totally
Wikipedia.
Tell. Okay, this brings us to a different area. The difference between Canadians and Americans. And one of the things that I find fascinating is since we have so much exposure to the U.S. and their skeptical issues, a lot of us aren't even aware of the different legislation surrounding some of these issues. For example, our libel and slander laws, and even free speech laws, and separation of church and state. Steve, Think you were going to talk about this?
Yeah, well, I mean, Canada and the United States, for all our similarities, like we have these cultural, linguistic, geographic, demographic similarities and resource similarities, and we have the same media that gets bounced back and forth. But for all of these similarities, we kind of forget that we are our own country, even though we have these awesome Maple Leafs mittens and hats and toques that we wear all the time. We actually are a different country. And for instance, I think Canadians have this assumption that we have a separation of church and state, because both Canada and the United States are liberal democracies, and that separation of the two entities in the United States is a very pronounced item of political rhetoric. So it kind of makes sense that we just have the same separation. But in fact, there is no actual enshrined separation. Now, the American Constitution, it clearly states, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. But I think that most Canadians who aren't familiar with our Constitution, and by the way, I refer to the 1982 Charter of Rights and Freedoms, not the 1867 British North America Act.
Steve was in political science. I don't know if anybody noticed.
Yeah. But I think most people would be surprised that the preamble of our Constitution reads, whereas Canada is founded upon the principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law. Now, part of the confusion lay in how Canada and the United States and the U.S. treats their Constitution. Now, the Constitution of the United States very clearly enshrines in writing a set of principles and laws that define how a government actor is to behave or not to behave. But in Canada, we come from the English tradition of common law and constitutional convention. That is to say, precedent defines how our country operates under the law. So if something is done for a certain way for 150 years without being bothered to be written down in the books, well, that's the convention of our Constitution. And further complicating this issue is that Quebec operates under its own set of laws based on the old French system of civil law, which is similar to how the Criminal Code of Canada operates. If you do this, then that happens. If you do that, then this happens.
Right.
The Canadian Constitution is very difficult to get rid of this religious preamble because, unlike the American Constitution, our amending formula is very vague and it's unclear, and it's almost impossible to happen because things people just haven't figured out how to do it properly.
Right.
Now, you mentioned libel and slander laws.
Mm-hmm.
It's fairly widespread knowledge in the skeptical community about the case of Simon Singh and the BCA.
Mm-hmm.
The listeners that don't know about it, Simon Singh is a British science writer who wrote a column saying that the British Chiropractors Association happily promotes bogus treatments, end quote. And therefore, the British Chiropractors Association, the BCA, launched a libel salute against Singh. Now, libel laws in the UK work backwards compared to how they work in Canada and the US and other liberal democracies, because over in the UK, the burden of proof is on the defendant that they did not commit libel. So they are literally guilty until they prove themselves to be innocent. And in fact, their laws are so bad that if I write a column here in Canada and somebody in the UK gets a hold of it, prints it up and puts it in some magazine or for sale pamphlet in the UK, and someone in the UK could sue me for libel, and I would have to be brought to a UK court on my own dime to prove that I did not commit libel.
You don't have to be British
called libel tourism.
Sorry, say again, John?
I was just going to say that the person doesn't have to be British to sue you. Someone in Australia can sue you by as long as you were published in the UK.
Yep. Yeah, that's a very good point. And the Church of Scientology has been engaging in this practice for a while, too. And this phenomenon is called libel tourism. And now other countries are now having to rewrite their legal code to protect their own citizens, because this is not only a legal threat to you and I and to free speech, but it's also a sovereignty threat to other nations, because it dictates that our own laws cannot be exercised in our own country. There are very serious efforts underway by American lawmakers and judicial experts and academics to protect American citizens from libel tourism, arranging it so that if libel charges that would not stand in an American court, then an American citizen would not be held responsible for the charges in another country. But I've looked, and I can't seem to find any serious movement outside of the scientific community of Canadian lawmakers and judicial experts and other academics that are standing up to the UK's atrocious libel laws. We're just kind of letting it go by. And I think that can really... that's risky. I think that Canadian skeptics would be well advised that we're still on the hook for libel tourism unless we effect some legal change here at home.
And this is something that is especially important to us right now because there's a new skeptical blog project in Canada, and we don't want to be sued. So, Steve, why don't you just tell us about Skeptic North?
Yeah, Skeptic North, its genesis was just after TAM. For those of you that got to go to TAM, there was this communications network set up by yourself, Des, and Scott Gavora of Science Based Pharmacy. And from there, this communication back and forth, a bunch of Canadian skeptics, bloggers, and writers kind of got together and said, well, why don't we just have our own skeptic voice and organize on our own? Because I think we're all kind of sick of waiting for somebody else to do it or just assuming that the American example is good enough for us. So we got together and did it ourselves, and we've been in operation for a week and a day so far. We have writers from across the country. We're still missing some major markets, such as all of Saskatchewan and Manitoba. We have no writers from those areas, or Quebec for that matter. But by and large, we're getting more writers, and we're dealing with our local regional issues, but getting a national voice in a way that just hasn't happened before.
And that's what I want to talk about. Now, until this, there really was no national voice. So we didn't have much of a way to figure out what each other were doing. For example, like, John, what's going on in the Ottawa Skeptics?
Well, we're just a local organization. We've done some local investigations. We have a monthly meeting, but now it's turned into a lecture. So we have now a monthly lecture with different guest lecturer. We have, you know, Skeptics in the Pub, which guys in Vancouver do regularly. So just the typical local stuff, and you can see it all on our site. It's nice that we now have this pan-Canadian blog where we can share all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And get the word out.
And actually, like, Jesse's group is just crazy active. Jesse, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, the Center for Inquiry has been active in Canada for, I believe it's over 2 years now. It's not over 2 years, and it's just about 2 years. But they were in Ontario for a year before they really began spreading it, and now they're popping up all over the place. We've got centers in every major city across the country. And in Vancouver, we've been going a little bit over a year. We do a monthly lecture series, which is quite well attended. I mentioned we had Harriet Hall, the Skeptoc, come up a few months ago. That was one of our biggest talks. Different topics, you know, science, philosophy, skepticism. And the Center for Inquiry from Ontario has been doing some great stuff in the last couple of years as well. That, you know, national press, the guy in charge has been on TV. He writes a column in the National Post. So it is becoming a major voice of skepticism and humanism and atheism and all that good stuff that the CFI does within Canada.
So I guess what I want to know is, if we have active groups all over the country, and they've been going on for a while, why did it take us this long to get together and get a blog project going?
Well, my first post for Skeptic North dealt with this specific issue is why now? Why not 20 years ago when other major skeptic organizations were really starting to get some national organizationing down pat? Canada has always had this really rough problem of regionalism from province to region to region. Political scientists all throughout Canada have divided Canada into six regions: British Columbia, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, the Maritimes, and the North. And it's really hard to get these regions to talk to each other because of the various religious, cultural, linguistic, geographic resource demands that are from region to region. And it's a serious challenge to get somebody from Ontario to get along with somebody from Alberta, for instance, or Quebec to get along with somebody from British Columbia. I believe regionalism. That is the nature of the beast.
I think it might also be that we've just been missing the leadership needed to get things moving. You know, like the U.S., they have James Randi and Michael Shermer. Mm-hmm. We just might be missing one of those guys, you know, which is kind of unfortunate because James Randi is Canadian in origin, but he's moved to the U.S. now.
Yeah.
We've had our own few skeptical greats, but most of them are no longer with us. Mm-hmm. So we're left here picking up the pieces and trying to start fresh.
So we actually have a tweet.
This comes from Zen Monkey. How can we lay skeptics best help the movement? What would you like us non-names to do in support?
Well, the way I kind of got my skeptic start is, aside from my own blog, somecanadianskeptic.com, is I was a commenter at the various skeptical communities, a skeptic in particular. I also commented, a regular commenter on Bad Astronomy and occasionally on Pharyngula and a few other sources. That's a great way to help not only practice your skepticism and to learn how to be a skeptic, but it also builds a skeptic community and this communications infrastructure that people can just get to know each other and, like, hey, there's this issue out in Vancouver. I know somebody in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. They comment over on this thing that I comment on. Commenting on these various threads and forums are a great way to just build this community of communication. It's been fantastic.
Jesse, what would you say?
There's a document that's edited by Daniel Loxton. You mentioned he's in Vancouver. He's actually in Victoria, but small distinction. It's called
Depending
What
on
Do
if
I
you
Do
Live
Next.
There, that's a small distinction, my friend.
Well, all right, fair enough.
Okay.
Anyway, so he published this, or he edited this large document called What Do I Do Next? Leading Skeptics Discuss 105 Practical Ways to Promote Science and Advance Skepticism. And it's full of 105 practical ways to promote science and advance skepticism. Mm-hmm. For lay people. It's mostly stuff you can do for free or for extremely cheap. It's got some great ideas, and it's for free online. I don't know exactly where you go to get it. I'm sure it's available through...
It's on skeptic.com. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And I agree with you, Jesse.
It's Daniel Loxton as well.
It's fantastic. Yep. I think that should be mandatory reading for skeptics.
Yeah. Yep.
John, what would you say?
If I could add something, which is that, what is this, like, you know, non-names? Are we, like, big names, or what's so special about
us? That's a very good point.
Yeah?
We are lay people as well, Zen Monkey.
That's right.
I'm no scientist. I'm no magazine publisher or anything. The way I got started on this is I discovered skepticism, and I looked around the town to see if there's any skeptics groups. There wasn't one. So I started one. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, and I still don't. But I'm having a good time, and look around town. If there's no skeptic group, start one. If there is one, join up. If they suck, start another one, or try to change them. You know, just get involved. Just get off your butt. You know, get out there.
Yeah, Skeptics in the Pub takes all of 2 hours to organize, or, you know, a skeptic camp. You can start really small. In Vancouver, we had a small grassroots skeptic camp, and the next year we were hosted in a big college, and it really, I mean, not to undervalue all of the effort that people put into it, it's a lot of great people working very hard, but it's not something that's impossible to do if you're just a lay skeptic.
And I would also like to point out that this show makes it really easy to get involved. You can call in, you can do a speaking up, you can, I don't know if anybody knows now, but if you listen online and you link to it directly from our website, there's video as well and a chat room. We are pushing the technological boundaries. There's so many ways of getting involved in the skeptical community, and the Canadian National Movement is really in effect just starting out with Skeptic North. So everyone do get involved. So what would you say, guys? Expect big things?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I've been really, really, dare I say, touched by the incredibly positive support that we've been getting from not just the skeptical community from around the world. The Americans and the Australians have been really supportive in plugging our site and plugging what we've been doing, but also just Canadian people in general who aren't even just Canadian skeptics, who are Canadian science-friendly people. I think people have been waiting for this voice for a long time, and it's I expect big things.
Well, and on that note, we are out of time for today. So thanks so much to John Abrams, Steve Toms, and Jesse Brattle for being here. And if you want to check out everyone who appeared on the show today, visit skepticnorth.com. And after that, visit our website, at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can download the podcast version of this episode by noon on Sunday. That's MDT. Or you can avoid having to remember that at all by clicking the iTunes link and subscribing to the show. And perhaps while you're on iTunes, you could write a review. We very much appreciate that kind of thing. From the website, you can also join our Facebook group or follow us on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. So thanks very much for listening. Thanks to you guys so much for being here.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall off, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for the government. And everything you believe is a lie.
Everything.